Welcome to the Cutting the Gordian Knot podcast. Today we are joined by economist E.J. Anthony of the Heritage Foundation. He's been featured on the Wall Street Journal, Fox News, Fox Business, National Review, but more than any of that, he is featured right here, right now on the Cutting the Gordian Knot podcast to talk about fractional reserve lending. Welcome to the podcast, E.J.
Thank you for having me.
Of course, looking forward to the discussion. So I'd like to kick it off with a brief summary of what exactly fractional reserve lending is. This is a subject which we have not tackled yet on the podcast, so some of the listeners might not be familiar. And honestly, it's something I've not made up my mind on. I used to be pretty strongly in support of a full reserve solution of some stripe, but it's a complicated issue, and I don't pretend to be an expert. So I want to hear some of your critiques of our current system. Then if we have time, we'll run into a few alternatives. So if you can lay out the landscape, that would be awesome.
I'd be happy to. Fractional reserve banking, the critics will say that it is essentially legalized fraud. And even the most ardent proponents of it have to admit that it is a system that works only so long as until it doesn't, which sounds kind of silly, but let me explain exactly what it is, its mechanics, and then I think those different critiques and assessments become a lot clearer. So when you deposit money at a bank, we like to think that the bank keeps our money there because they tell us we can go back anytime we want and get our money. That's what a demand deposit means. It is available on demand. But the stark reality is that's not the case. As soon as we deposit that money at the bank, as quick as it can, is going to loan that money out to someone else. Why? Well, because it's an idle resource and they want to make money on that resource. They make money on money by lending it out. And so whether that's a mortgage or a credit card, a student loan, an auto loan, you name it, they need to loan out that money in order to make money on it. The other thing is that banks are already paying you interest. Now you may say, what are you talking about? I get like no interest on my checking or savings account. You know, we're still in an environment of very artificially low rates when it comes to deposits. But historically, those deposit rates have been much higher. And so as a consequence, the bank needed to earn money on your deposit in order to pay you your interest on that same deposit. So the bank knows that they can't lend out all of your money because you're going to come asking for it at some point. But they do know that most of the time, you're not going to be asking for your money. And that's true for all the other depositors at the bank as well. So what the bank can do essentially is if you come and ask for your deposit back, they can pay you what's left of your money that hasn't been lent out, but they can also pay you portions of everyone else's money that hasn't been lent out. And historically, as long as a bank keeps somewhere around 10% of deposits on hand available for depositors to actually get their money back, things are fine. But that only works, again, until it doesn't. When does it stop working? When more than that 10% of people want their money back. That can happen for a whole host of different reasons, some of which actually stem precisely from fractional reserve banking itself. And there's this wonderful scene in the movie, It's a Wonderful Life, a great Christmas movie with Jimmy Stewart. I'll spare you my Jimmy Stewart impression, by the way, since I haven't had enough to drink yet today. But basically, all of these depositors are in a panic because they hear that another bank failed. And so they all rush to this bank to get their money out because they're afraid the same thing's going to happen. And it becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy where everyone quickly discovers that this bank, just like the other one, does not actually have their money on hand. However, that was not necessarily indicative of this particular bank being in bad health, as it was so much indicative of the entire fractional reserve banking system being legalized fraud.
Okay. So in that situation, there is money in existence to cover those depositors, but it may be at another bank. So can you explain why can't, or in what scenarios can that bank that we're talking about, who all of a sudden gets a huge demand, in what situations can they simply borrow from other banks who ended up getting those original deposits deposited in their bank and then therefore paying back the people who are demanding their deposits?
That's a great question. So historically, this is where the more conservative bankers tended to make the most money, right? Think of J.P. Morgan, John Pierpont Morgan. So what Pierpont did was he always had a very conservative portfolio with his investments and always had an ample cash reserve because he knew that fractional reserve banking causes these boom bust cycles. Now, how on earth does that happen? Well, when you, again, put that money on deposit at the bank, look, think of it in terms of accounting, if you will, for a moment, debits and credits, right? You have in your personal ledger, if you will, you have a debit of a dollar. The bank has a credit of a dollar. In other words, you have an asset, they have a liability. Now, that liability on the bank's book is also offset by an asset of the same amount, which is just the physical cash on hand. But let's say they take 90 cents of that dollar and they loan it out to somebody. The bank now is missing that 90 cents and it has an asset equal to 90 cents. And you may say, but that doesn't make any sense at all. If the bank has money, it's a liability. And if they don't have it, it's an asset. Yes, that's exactly what's happening here because the money due to the bank is counted as an asset. And the person who borrowed that 90 cents, they have that 90 cents in cash, but they also have a 90 cent liability, which is the money has to be paid back to the bank, right? That is a bill due to the bank. So if you think about it in terms of assets and liabilities or debits and credits, nothing has changed. Everything zeros out. But the problem is that we just created 90 cents because I'm the depositor. My dollar is still at the bank as far as I'm concerned, right? My checkbook still says a dollar, but that other person's checkbook now says 90 cents in addition to my dollar. We just expanded the money supply. So what fractional reserve banking does is it causes the economic boom bust cycle because it causes this expansion in the money supply, which temporarily fuels economic growth, but then prices rise and people realize that in real terms, the economy hasn't grown at all. And then we get a violent contraction of credit, which leads to the bust. And then the cycle simply repeats as interest rates rise and fall, chasing the boom and the bust in the overall economy. So tying this all back in, when you had those very, very conservative bankers who essentially did not allow themselves to be taken in by that boom bust cycle, again, Pierpont is the best example, I think, of that. What happened when there was a crisis? He had the cash on hand. And he had a liquid enough position that he was able to meet that crisis. And his reward for doing so was the fact that he got to buy up a lot of other business on the cheap. But the problem is that with fractional reserve banking, you are institutionalizing essentially this boom bust cycle, and you are creating a situation where the vast majority of banks are all going to have excess cash or need cash at the same time. And so this idea that we need a lender of last resort, right? That's a role of the Federal Reserve, a lender of last resort. That has been so indoctrinated in our minds that we think of it as sacrosanct today. It's just a necessity of the marketplace. It's not. It's a necessity of fractional reserve banking. And so the problem with relying on banks to help each other or even relying on a central authority to help the banks is that we are not treating the cause, we are treating a symptom of the problem. That's a lot. I hope that makes sense, but please let me know if I need to clarify anything there.
No, I think you laid that out well. I like that you brought in the accounting perspective because sometimes we talk about this in very abstract ways without actually matching what's going on in particular. Now, this channel deals a lot with philosophy, and we've had more than anybody philosophers on. And philosophy is the art of making distinctions. So I'm going to make one here, and I'd love to hear your thoughts on it. Let me kind of tell the story that you were telling, but with one additional piece of the puzzle. So you discussed how we have we debit to our account when we have cash at the bank, but that's a liability. So that's a credit on the bank side. Well, we also have this whole event happening because somebody is demanding a loan of some type, which brings money into existence in the way that you were talking about earlier through fractional reserve lending. So here are two scenarios that I think are in fact distinct, one of which I think is certainly causing a boom bust cycle. And the other one, I don't think it is, though I want to hear your thoughts on it. So let me start with what I think the good scenario is. Let's say somebody's building a house. So we have a contractor. I'm actually a contractor. I build houses. So I'm building a house. Now, as I build it, I have a construction loan, which reimburses me for what has come into existence. So I'm increasing an asset. I'm actually creating value. And then as the value comes into existence, my bank, by refunding me with the construction loan, is creating new dollars in proportion to the quantity of new asset which is coming to existence in my building activity. So by the very end, I have a construction loan, which is new money that's come into existence through fractional reserve lending. And now I have a new asset of a house. And now that loan gets extinguished when somebody pulls out a loan of their own in the form of a mortgage to purchase my house. So now we pay back the construction loan. I receive that money. So now we have some type of profit, hopefully, fingers crossed, right? And that seems to make sense because we have, say, a $400,000 new thing in the economy. So in order to facilitate transactions of purchases and sales, we'll need an increase in the total amount of currency. And that's what happened. So that seems to be a match. We've increased the total amount of assets in, let's say, the US, and now we've increased the money supply to match that. We should have stable prices. So let me lay out scenario two, which I disagree with, and I want to hear your thoughts on the two. The other one is, let's say I go to the bank because I want to eat better quality cheese and drink more wine and better quality wines. So I want to borrow some of my ability to consume in the future, and I want to enjoy it today. So I take out a loan, the money supply expands, I purchase a bunch of just consumable products. Well, now it seems that we haven't actually increased the quantity of assets which are now being bought and sold in the economy. We've just borrowed consumption from the future to now, which seems to be the definition of what's going on with a bubble. Because now we're going to have the bust later when I drop my consumption because I have to pay a loan. We're extinguishing dollars against debt, and the whole process goes in reverse. So in the first scenario, I'm not sure if I really hate this whole fractional reserve lending system. It makes some sense. But in the second, it absolutely seems to fall to that boom-bust cycle critique. So I'd love your thoughts on that.
Well, I'm not sure why we would draw a distinction between a quote-unquote asset, which I think you're trying to, what you're trying to get at there is the distinction between investment and consumption. Correct me if I'm wrong, but that seems to be the distinction there. So on the one hand, we're creating something that will have a return, and in the other case, we're creating something that is just going to be consumed. But at the end of the day, you're still talking about goods and services within the economy, and money is used to buy both. This is part of the qualitative flaw in some different monetary schools of thought, which played out horrifically in the late 1920s when they thought the people at the levers of power thought that they could control where money was going to go. In other words, we want to make credit cheap and easily available to businessmen, but we don't want it to be used for speculation. Guess what? Dollars are fungible, and everything is priced in dollars, not just investment. And so you can very easily move dollars from investment to consumption and vice versa. And I just don't see the logic behind distinguishing one from the other. In other words, why is it that one would be inflationary and the other would not? We treat spending sometimes in a very selfish manner. I don't mean that we're spending the money on ourselves, but we think of it purely from our own perspective. In other words, I go and I buy something that's purely consumable. Let's say food. I just go to a restaurant and I buy a bunch of food and I eat it. Well, who did I give that money to? The person who owns the restaurant. What are they going to do with it? They're going to pay their workers. They're going to pay the rent for the building, right? That's an investment. The building itself, they're going to pay for new machines, whether that's ovens, fryers, refrigerators, you name it. Again, you're talking about putting money into capital goods, into investment. So we sometimes forget that how we spend our money has far-reaching impacts beyond just what it does to us. It affects a lot of other people in a lot of different ways. So I hope that kind of clarifies that there really isn't that there isn't that distinction that may appear at first. We're still talking about money, which is spent on all types of goods and services, not just certain ones. You know, going back to the home building example, though, if I may, I think the thing that's very, very important to remember here is you've taken out a loan, you've increased the money supply, except that what happens when you pay that loan back?
It extinguishes.
Exactly. But have you extinguished the asset?
No, but there was a new loan that came into existence, which expanded the money supply in the form of a mortgage.
Right, exactly. And now what happens when that mortgage gets paid back?
The money extinguishes, right?
Is the asset extinguished?
No, but typically you, not always, but oftentimes something which will last for a much longer time will get continually put up as an asset against a debt. So houses can last for a very long time. So their mortgage will get extinguished at the end of their mortgage. But then if it still has life, it may be depreciated and be sold again at a lower cost. So now the asset is marked down. And then the mortgage, which would be applied to that, would be smaller than the original, but that would reflect the change in the value of the asset, right?
Oh, certainly, absolutely. But
until it's gone, right? Until my house crumbles, at which point there's going to be no new dollars that come into existence that make a claim against that asset, the debt claim throughout that asset.
Sure, but we still have a couple of problems here. One of which is the fact that we're requiring a lot of speculation to make this work in a 1-to-1 ratio, where we're causing the amount of money that exists to go up, to increase precisely by the actual value of goods and services being added to the economy. But the other issue here is that you're not actually talking about increasing the total amount of goods and services in the economy by the price of that house, because a lot, if not all, of the materials and the labor that go into that house already existed beforehand. Mm-hmm. And so the actual value that's being added is the difference between the total price that the consumer is willing to pay for all of those inputs individually and the final product. So let's say everything that goes into to building this home is $200,000. And I know these numbers are completely unrealistic at today's home prices, but just as an example. And then the final sale value is $250,000. That tells you that the work that was done, the human effort that was done to transform all of those inputs into the output to the consumer, that was worth $50,000. Now, obviously, the entire house together is worth $250,000. But the point is that if you're going to increase the money supply, you actually don't want to increase it by the total sale price of the home. You want to increase it by the value that was added from the human effort that went in to transform all of those inputs into outputs. And so you are still going to have an inflationary impact through fractional reserve banking if you allow the person to take out the loan for the total price of the house, or even if it's 20% down, whatever the case may be, you are still going to have that inflationary impact. Conversely, imagine if you had a money supply that was fixed based on some kind of commodity. Gold was the classic monetary system. In that case, the only way to expand the money supply was to exert human effort to go out and get gold. And what you observe over time is that the amount of human effort it takes to go out and get gold out of the ground would be equal to the amount of human effort it took to, let's say, build this house, given the ratio of the price of gold to the price of the value added in building that house. In other words, let's say it took, again, random number, 100 man hours to take all of the inputs and turn it into the output of this house, okay? And we said $50,000 was the amount of the difference in the value between the inputs and the finished product. You could take, therefore, 100 man hours and go out and collect $50,000 worth of gold, assuming a well-functioning financial market, which typically is what you had under that gold standard. And you don't need fractional reserve banking at all to make that happen.
Oh, I definitely want to get into the gold standard stuff, but let's circle back real quick. You made a distinction between consumption and investment. And yeah, I'm making something pretty similar here. When we're kind of talking about that balance sheet, I'm looking at what's actually backing things, what's available on a balance sheet to do the backing. So if you're a company, if you spend something on an expense versus if you spend it on an asset, well, that you can't borrow against an expense, but you can borrow against an asset. So that's kind of the distinction which I'm making, which if we're talking about loans coming into existence, I want to see if they're based on assets or if they're based on expenses. So it's quite similar to the consumption investment distinction you're making. However, I think that just on an accounting basis, I kind of want to hear the accounting story of how exactly that works with what you were describing earlier.
So you're drawing the issue of collateral, right?
Right. So we have collateral mm-hmm. in the case of I'm borrowing against an asset. So a new asset comes into existence, we borrow against it. Maybe another asset somewhere else is going out of existence, and hopefully the money supply in aggregate stays, you know, stable enough to have stable prices. But let's just stick to this one part here. So we have an asset coming into existence and we can borrow against it. When we borrow against it, we now have new money. That money is backed by that loan, and that loan is now backed by an asset. I guess I was a little unclear with how that story's different from I wish to have a group of expenses, and I'll take a loan on the group of expenses. And then that loan, which is based on the expenses, which I was consuming, is then creating new dollars. Thus, the dollars, in a sense, are not backed by an asset in that example. They're instead backed by an expense, which I don't think actually is real collateral for a loan and would cause a boom-bust cycle down the line.
Well, again, the problem is that you don't price things in collateral. You price them in money.
Mm-hmm.
And money and collateral are not synonymous, although in some financial markets with highly liquid collateral, they are treated as such. So you don't need additional collateral to increase the money supply. You only need to do that if, again, if you're talking about a fractional reserve banking system and someone is not really sure they're going to get their money back because those dollars don't actually exist, right? Mm-hmm. They've been created ex nihilo, out of nothing, essentially. And when you have such a shaky base for the system, a person is going to require more collateral because there is more risk. And you know, in that sense, you could say maybe there's an increased requirement of capital goods to stay on the sideline, but that's a whole nother discussion. But the point remains that I don't price all of the goods and services I buy in collateral. I price them in dollars.
Right.
And so you want the total amount of goods and services, whether they're investment or not, whether they're mm-hmm. consumption or not, you want the total size of your economy to match the money supply. And when the growth of one outpaces the growth of the other, we're going to have problems.
Gotcha. Okay. Well, let's jump right into the what we were talking about with the gold standard stuff and the time that we have left. Now, one critique is that it can cause kind of what you were saying earlier. Somebody can choose to create that $50,000 in value, or they could choose to spend $50,000 worth of labor in mining gold. That seems to be an unproductive use. Doesn't that seem to be wasteful, applying that just in order to have money? Or do you think that's worth it somehow? And then kind of a follow-up to that is, oftentimes it's Russia and China and Venezuela being the largest producers of gold. And if gold was what backs our money, that's almost like allowing them to dig a hole in the ground and pull US dollars out.
Well, as opposed to what else? What else could they do with those resources? What else could they do with that human effort? What else could they do with that time?
They could create something, a good or service, and exchange it for a good and service that we had, and then we could both benefit from comparative advantage. But if they just mine gold with that labor, and then they put that gold in one of their banks, well, then they have more gold backing their currency, which means their currency would be stronger vis-a-vis our currencies. And stop me if I get something wrong here. So their currency would be stronger vis-a-vis our currency. Therefore, they could demand that we produce goods and services and send it to them, because now their currency has increased in value and made imports for them from us cheaper. And they get to demand our goods and services simply because they made an activity over in their side of the economy of just putting a shiny metal into their bank, not because they used their productive power to exchange a real good to us.
Well, not unless we don't want the gold. I mean, that whole system breaks down if we don't actually want the gold, which is the case today, which is why they're not mining. You know, we forget that a stable money supply is a good in and of itself. Mm-hmm. And so it is highly desirable that we would return to such a system. This idea that somehow you can simply dig the gold out of the ground at no cost, and that you can sell it to someone else and it provides no benefit, and that you somehow reap a mountain of rewards, is frankly a little silly. If that was the case, then everyone would be doing it everywhere. But it's simply not the case. And it wasn't the case when we had a worldwide gold standard, at least on all the major currencies. That simply did not happen. And so you have to ask yourself why. It's because it takes a tremendous amount of effort. And you may say, well, isn't that wasted effort then? Well, what's the alternative? The alternative is a system run by bureaucrats, run by technocrats, run by party apparatchiks who have no incentive to actually keep the currency stable. Their incentive is and always is to inflate, because it provides them and their party cronies with money to spend at the public expense. Inflation is a hidden tax on everyone who holds and uses that currency. And so it is essentially a massive wealth transfer. To put that in perspective, if you compare the average hourly wage in America today to January of 2021, you will find, after you adjust for inflation, that the average American worker now loses more on his hourly wages to inflation, to the hidden tax of inflation, than he does in federal income taxes. In other words, inflation has effectively doubled what the average American worker today pays on his hourly wages in terms of how much gets forked over to the federal government. And so we have to remember, life is not about solutions. It's about alternatives. This is never going to be a perfect world. We have to wait until the next life if we want a perfect world. And hopefully we get there. I don't know if I myself will or not. But the point is that you cannot talk about anything involving humans, especially a monetary system, without discussing the alternatives. You cannot talk about an ideal, because the ideal doesn't exist. And thus far, the best system that has ever been thought of and has ever actually been implemented has been that gold standard.
So, quick question on that. Some people I've heard say that the gold standard is naturally balances itself in various business cycles. Other people have said that it's actually a pro-cyclical system. So which do you think it is? Do you think it's pro or counter-cyclical? How exactly does the gold standard balance out those ebbs and flows in the economy? How exactly does that work?
That's a great, great question. And we want to distinguish here between gold standards and gold standards in a fractional reserve banking system. So in a fractional reserve banking system, when you introduce certain kinds of frictions in growing the money supply, such as the gold gold backing, you can actually exacerbate the boom bust cycle or the business cycle. But that is not because of there being a gold standard. It's because you have a fractional reserve banking system. In those rare cases when you simply had a gold standard without fractional reserve banking, which we have to go back a pretty long time to find that. But under those circumstances, you simply didn't have a boom bust cycle. Gold actually works to counter the boom bust cycle. And the reason for that is because as soon as prices deviate a little bit, the people mining gold either stop mining because it's not worth it, they go do something else. You know, if let's say instead of, you know, mining gold, I'm going to put down my shovel and my pick, and I'm going to pick up a handsaw and I'm going to start making wagon wheels, you know, random item, but the point still stands. As soon as it's no longer the best use of my time, I will go do something else. But likewise, if the value of gold rises disproportionately to goods and services in the economy, I'm going to put down my axe. I'm going to stop making wagon wheels. I'm going to pick up a shovel and a pick, and I'm going to go mine gold because that's now the better use of my time. And so there was always a very fast response in terms of the quantity of money, because gold was treated as money. Gold was more common than the paper that was used as a receipt money, essentially. So you had this incredibly quick response between inputs into the economy and people's choices, in other words, how they responded, and the result was very, very stable money. The other thing that is probably good to distinguish for the American audience, which I'm assuming your audience is primarily American, is that you had several periods in United States history when there was essentially a dual backing of gold and silver. And so whenever you had the relative price of gold and silver deviate from the government-defined ratio, you always had a further exacerbation of the boom-bust cycle. Because let's say you started having an inflationary cycle and the supply of gold was no longer keeping up with the goods and services in the economy. Why? Because it wasn't worth it at that point for me to mine gold. I'm better off producing goods and services at these inflated prices. Well, that might not necessarily be the case for silver producers as well, depending on how far out of equilibrium the ratio between gold and silver was. And so you could have one monetary source, one monetary metal, stop its inflationary impulse, if you will, but the other one would then continue. And so that could, again, further exacerbate the boom. And also, whenever, you know, the bigger the boom, the bigger the bust. So not only would it exacerbate one side of the cycle, but the other as well.
Gotcha. So if we change to a gold standard today, would you still want, exchange rates with other currencies to be variable, to be floating? Because back then it seems, my economic history back then is a little fuzzy, but it seems like there's commonly fixed exchange rates, or is that just not the case?
Oh, we had both for a very long time. We had fixed exchange rates, but, you know, between different currencies. And, you know, that would be a best case scenario, I think, is if we had all of these governments around the world not only returning to gold, but at fixed rates. And so you could then establish very easily fixed rates between different currencies. And then investors and consumers' confidence in currencies would be gauged on how much one currency versus another is used for international commerce. But what would be much more likely to happen is that if the United States got back on gold, we would have to have variable exchange rates, because there is almost no impulse anywhere else in the world to return to a gold standard. The United States was the last country to leave it. The vast majority of nations around the world had left their gold standards long before we did. So I think it is highly, highly unlikely that anyone else would join us. And so you'd have to have fixed exchange rates. And those exchange rates then would tell you not only how much those currencies are worth in dollars, but because the dollar would return to being a dollar, which is a unit of weight, by the way, it would tell you what those other currencies are worth in gold as well.
Now, it seems like with monetary economics, you can grab on to certain pieces and make them still, make them stop, make them fixed, but that can push variation into other places in the economy. So under the gold standard, we fix the price of gold to a certain amount of dollars. So they are backed with some type of ratio. Whereas now we allow that to move. So my question is, if we fix gold to dollars, will prices be more variable? Will they take up that movement more than what we have today in our fiat currency system? What does that look like historically with price variation under the two systems?
There has to date been no monetary system that had more price variability than fiat. The only reason we even use a fiat system is because it is mandated by law. I used to ask my students when I taught money and banking, what does that mean that we have a fiat system? And almost universally, they would say, I don't know. And the few who had any idea would say, oh, fiat means it's backed by the full faith and credit of the government. Nothing could be further from the truth. Fiat means by decree. If you look on a Federal Reserve note, what we commonly call a dollar, what does it say? It says this is legal tender for all debts, public and private. Meaning if you are offered this for payment of goods and services and you do not accept it, you go to jail. That's not an exaggeration. It is legal tender. We have legal tender laws, meaning you have to use this currency. Why is that a law? You only have a law because you want someone to do something or you want them not to do it, right? We have laws against murder to discourage murder. We have a law saying you have to use this currency because if that law wasn't in place, no one would use it because the currency is not worth anything. Conversely, again, under a gold standard, gold has alternative uses. And that is one of, not the only, but that is one of the reasons why it works in terms of backing a currency.
Now, this has got to be the last question because we're running out of time. I appreciate you coming on. But, you know, often you hear fiat currency is not, it's not worth anything. But it seems with our accounting story, well, my dollar is worth something because it's a claim on the bank. Well, why is that claim valuable? Well, because the bank in turn has a claim on a loan. Well, what does that matter? Because the loan is a claim on somebody's ability to repay. So it's either a claim on an asset or it's a claim on somebody's ability to pay into the future. It's a claim on their income. So what backs my dollar? Well, in a roundabout sense, can it be fair to say that it's a claim ultimately through the banks as an intermediary on either an asset or on an income stream of some type?
Well, that's what debt is, which brings us to the very important point that our money is debt. Mm-hmm. This is a shocking realization, and it might scramble your brain a little bit. So, you know, strap in here. But if you and I and every person and every institution, including the government, if we all repaid back all of our debt, there would be no money.
Right.
Poof, it's
would
gone.
Would there be less than no money? As I understand it, the total quantity of debt exceeds what M3 money supply or whatever you want to do. What measure of money would we even use to compare it to the total amount of debt?
Well, all of them would go to zero because they would they decline at different rates. And you bring up a very good point, especially, you know, when we start talking about financial derivatives and the rehypothecation of U.S. treasuries, for example, you have to realize that some of these different monetary measures, which are much larger than M2 and obviously much larger than the physical cash in circulation, those would decline faster because you have more dollars worth of assets based on the same dollar asset over here in a different category, again, like M2 or another smaller measure. And so they would all decline at different rates, essentially, because they have pyramided through fractional reserve banking at different rates. And so just as they grew at different rates, they would collapse back to zero at different rates as well.
So we'd be left with coins, right? Because... because coins are the only thing which isn't created with a corresponding debt, right?
Oh, no. Even that, actually. Literally, all of our money today is debt. It's not backed by debt. It is debt. And as those debts are canceled, whatever physical currency is left would actually ultimately have to be destroyed.
Right. No, that makes sense. That makes total sense. I'm just kind of asking a small point about when the U.S. mints coins, as I understand it, they don't actually, when they create a new coin, have to have a debt on the other side of the balance sheet. They just say it's just equity in the commonwealth. Thus, we had the whole ridiculous idea of printing a $1 trillion coin in order to get around the debt limit.
Well, but that would require the Federal Reserve purchasing it, though.
Right.
And so when I say the currency deposit, would have to be destroyed, I mean, theoretically, it could go back in a vault in the treasury, but it could not actually be counted as currency anymore. Rather, not the treasury, but the mint.
Right. As soon as it hits a debt, it extinguishes. EJ, you've been more than generous with your time, and I really appreciate your perspectives on this. I could talk with you for another bazillion hours about 1,000 things. I'd love to get into shadow banking and the ins and outs of various gold-backed systems and stuff, but we might have to leave that for a future conversation. Where can people find the work that you have been doing? Can you please direct them to a couple resources they can look up?
Oh, sure. So the best place to find me is going to be on Twitter or X, I don't know, whatever we're calling it these days. But I post all of my articles as well as all my daily analyses of different data releases, commentaries, et cetera. You'll find it all there. And the account is at Real EJ Antoni, A-N-T-O-N-I.
Awesome. And I encourage everybody to check that out. All right. Well, thanks for joining me today.
No, thank you for having me.
Of course.